Welcome to the Human and Technology Podcast. This podcast is for anyone who develops, distributes, or uses technology. For all those who always have the feeling that technology overwhelms or dominates them. For everyone who wants to know how to deal with technology in everyday life. For anyone who wants to understand what technology does to us and how we can get our lives back. This podcast is for those who want to make technology sexy. All the product developers, designers, UX, UI professionals, product managers, CTOs, and CEOs. And it is for you. My name is Dr. Peter Ryska. My friends call me Dr. Peter. I am your host, and I am happy that you are here. When I started my podcast about half a year ago, I asked a couple of potential listeners what format they would like. First of all, what the optimal length of an episode is. It turned out it's about 20 to 30 minutes. So I'm trying to limit my podcast to 30, 35 minutes. And so we're having the first episode today of a longer podcast. The second episode then on the same will be next week. So it's about the industrial revolutions that we have. We had four of them, and that's the nature of things. This first episode deals with the industrial revolution number one and number two. Next week then number three and number four. The Industrial Revolution happened in basically four different steps, called the first, the second, the third, and the fourth Industrial Revolution. Sometimes Industry 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, 4.0. What I will do in this podcast episode is run through the time, have a look at all the different phases, the different revolution, the industrial revolutions we had, and analyze how the relationship between human and machine has changed over time. In the beginning, a quick definition phase. If we talk about the relationship between humans and machines, we should have a short look at what a machine is, what the definition of a machine is. There are basically two of them. One is the more academic definition. So a machine is a mechanical or electronic construct, an artifact that is used to complete tasks. We are in situation A and want to be in situation B, and to go from A to B, we need some kind of mechanical or electronic device that helps us to complete this task. And this is not only a, let's say, spatial move from A to B, can also be a mental or a financial or whatever A and B that we have and we want to move from A to B, we can use machines in that. This is the more academic definition. So the popular definition of a machine is just like a steam engine, like a machine tool, like a robot, like production, construction machines, or maybe even a motorbike. So there is a commercial of Harley Davidson saying, "The machine you sit on tells the world where you stand." So this is can also be a machine by a popular definition. The definition I will use here is very close to the academic definition. So everything from a ball pen to a control room, from a light switch to a vehicle cockpit, all technologies, technology of all types and of all levels of complexity, is a machine. And it always has a purpose. So it's that move from A to B. So I am in London and I want to go to Paris. So I can use a machine, which could be a train or a car or maybe an airplane. That could be is a technological construct, a technological artifact that we can use to travel, for example. Or I have the task to drive to write the next version of my the next version of my podcast. So I take a piece of paper and I take a ball pen and write down a couple of words, make me a couple of bullet points that I have as a script to record the next podcast here. So that is also a machine by this definition. A little excursus here. The reason why this podcast is not called the Human Machine Podcast, but the Human Technology Podcast. The reason is that I want to reach very broad groups of people. I want to have very broad listener groups. And my idea was that if I call it the Human Machine Podcast, people outside the HMI community, outside the usability, user experience community, may believe, all right, he's talking about machine tools or robots or steam engines, or, but they will not take the machines I am talking about most of the time, like digital machines, like computers, like smartphones, like touchscreen devices, like cars, like in-vehicle systems. They are by many people not seen as machines in the popular definition. And technology is far broader. So I made the decision. I mean, I had already started to name it the Human Machine Podcasts. I had my logos done and the cover art that I'm using, that was all done with the Human Machine Podcast. And then one day I thought, no, this may exclude people that may be interested in what I have to say, and they read the name, interpret it the wrong way. And so I took the broader term Human Technology Podcast. This just as a little excursus here, a little footnote, why I have selected the name Human Technology Podcast. And since I was talking about machines anyway, so I took the chance to explain that. Industrialization went through several phases. In general, four of them are differentiated, and they are often named revolutions. These days, these years, the fourth industrial revolution is starting. The whole is called the Industrial Internet, which points at one of the special features of the fourth industrial revolution. That is connectivity, that is networking. Connectivity of machines, with other instances further away, but also the networking between humans and machines. The entire role is changing at the moment dramatically. And I will talk about this one at the end of the podcast when I talk about the fourth industrial revolution. But now, let's start in the beginning. So, the first industrial revolution that started in England in the late 18th century, in the rest of Europe and most parts of the US, it was more the early 19th century that it started. It was a turning point in human history. One, we still see, feel, recognize, maybe we suffer, maybe we enjoy it, but it is still very, very relevant for our today's world. It was the transition from a largely agricultural society to an industrial society, or from an agricultural economy to an industrial economy. So there had been products before, but they were built in manufacturing places, meaning small places, workshops, local little workshops. They were building instruments and tools and technology at that time. And so over the time, the switch from the agricultural to the industrial economy also led to a lowering of the number of small workshops building product. One core factor for this was the invention of the steam engine. That is closely associated with the name James Watt. So the unit Watt is still used for power today. So it's James Watt. He was not the original inventor of it, but he industrialized it. He lifted it to a level, the steam engine, to a level where it became universally applicable, where it was possible to use it in different contexts, like industry, like mobility, like in ships or in trains. So James Watt's inventions created the availability of power independent of humans or animals. In agricultural society, you can still see humans or animals pulling plows, working on the fields, delivering the energy to various processes. And the invention of the steam engine, with all the improvement James Watt engineered, that led to the independence of power of humans and animals. Another point connected to that was the invention of the loom and the invention of the railroads, of the trains. Both were powered, at least in parts, or widely by steam engines. So that was an application of it, but there were also many innovations in the looms to create fabrics of all kind, but also in the railroad, other inventions were required to get it going. England was favored by a number of factors. One is it is an island. They had, and they still have, many ports, and ships were at that time the most efficient and more or less the only means of transportation over long distances. So if you wanted to transport goods or persons over large distances, the ship was the number one means of transport, the number one transport vehicle. And being an island with many ports supported that. England had, which is also probably connected to the high number of ports and ships, they had colonies which were supplying raw materials as ores, coals, cotton. So they had access to this over large distances, and they could import it into England and ignite the Industrial Revolution. England has a comparably flat landscape, which eases the construction of traffic routes, of roads, of rails. So once you have all these ores, coals and cottons transported by ship into the port, it was comparably easy to distribute it within the country because they had this flat landscape. The population grew They had a more efficient agriculture in the late 18th century. And so there was a high efficiency there, and they had more calories to feed more people. They had more people surviving early childhood. So that there was a larger workforce. There were more people available to work. And they also had the initial hygiene measures at that time, washing hands and doing the very basic stuff, which is totally usual to us today, totally normal. But that was new at that time, and it also led to the fact that more babies survived, that you survived illness, sickness, injuries better, and so more people were available, so they had a bigger workforce. Other points why England was favored in the late 18th, early 19th century is they had a comparably liberal politics. They had an early version of what we see, what we recognize, what we live as democracy today. So they had a parliament, and they had less restrictions. They had a comparably long peace period. That also was favoring them because they didn't have to invest too much into military, into arms and weapons. So this peace period allowed them to focus more on industry. And they had the Calvinist thinking. And that was the idea that success, that professional success, that wealth are signs of God's favor. And that led to a certain business ethics. And that favored entrepreneurship, meaning that it was a normal thing to start a business. To have success was a good thing. It was a sign that I am a favorite of God. And so people were striving for that. And this combination then led to the establishment of new businesses and new companies. The HMI is the human-machine interfaces of the first industrial revolution were extremely weak. The machine totally dictated the relationship between human and machine. It was purely mechanical. It was, all mechanics, and it was a quite rustic implementation of these mechanics. There was a wheel, there was a switch, there was whatever, a lever, and then you had to push, to press, to pull, to rotate it, and something was happening right there where you did it. So the human was like a slave to the machine. The relationship between human and machine was driven by the technically possible. And the machine was constructed on ways what is possible, and then the human, with his high flexibility, mental flexibility, and physical flexibility, had to adapt to the machine. And so the early industrial revolution had a high price in losing health and life. I mean, there was a high risk to be injured or killed during the interaction with a machine. So we had this human as the slave, machine is driven by its limited technological capabilities, and so we had this relationship. Nonetheless, the start of modernization and industrialization in the turn from the 18th to the 19th century has changed the entire world, our entire lives, and it was the start of the hockey stick that we see in technological development. So there had been this mechanical development over quite some time, and then we had the first industrial revolution, and then the entire technological developments, the ubiquity of technology started. And from my point of view, we are still in the beginning of the hockey stick. So we are not really in the steep growth that we have. I mean, we are turning around to that in the last, let's say, 20, 30 years. So we are in exciting times, but they started in the late 18th century in England with the first industrial revolution. Let's move on to the second industrial revolution, or Industry 2.0, as some call it. That begins in the late 19th century. And it is the beginning of the electrification, the introduction of mass production, and the introduction of assembly lines. So this is the differentiator between the first and the second industrial revolution, electrification, mass production, and assembly lines. The electrification, meaning the introduction of electric power lines or the production of electric power, the distribution through power lines, and the realization of the power in electric engines, led to the availability of energy locally, right at the machines. And this was a big game changer. So electric machines were far smaller, far less dangerous, less noisy than the old steam engines. And you were able to place electrical engines right beside the machine. The old steam engines still had one big central engine, and then the power, the torque, or whatever you needed was transported through wheels, through gears, to the machine. Sometimes you had these belt systems. Yeah, you had one rotating line under the roof of a factory that was driven by the steam engine, and then you had a belt down to the machine driving the machine. And that was replaced by the electrification, by smaller, cleaner, and less noisy engines. Another thing that happened during the early phases of the second industrial revolution was the division of labor, the analysis of what are people doing. And that is closely connected with the name Taylor, James Taylor. I'll get back to him in a minute. But it led to specialization, to focus of people. And the role model for this, by the way, were the slaughterhouses in Chicago, where all the beef of the Midwest was turned into meat products. And they had a very strict division of labor. So there were people doing exactly this one thing with the animal, and then it moved on, hanging on chains to the second station where they did something different. And then at the very end, they had this, I don't know, sausages and steaks and whatever was made out of the cattle that was slaughtered in Chicago. So that was a very early example of a very high division of labor. The U.S., the second industrial revolution of the USA, was more shaped by this division of labor, by the Taylorism. As I said, is a guy called James Taylor that in the mid of the 19th century started to analyze work, having a look at people working, and found out, okay, there are people that are good in lifting goods and others are good in turning them around. And so he divided labor into small slices and assigned these small slices to certain persons. So we said, okay, Mr. A is doing exactly this just one thing, and Mr. B is doing something totally different, and Mrs. C is then doing again something totally different. And that was new at that time. So during the first industrial revolution, there was still one person doing larger amounts of work and not just single parts, single slices of the entire process. Opposed to the US in Europe, and particularly in Germany, the second industrial revolution was more driven by industries and product. First of all, chemistry and electrical engineering. So the name Siemens, most of you will know the company Siemens today, but that was a guy that introduced electrical engineering, that constructed various electrical products and then started his business. That was happening in Germany, and that was steering the or igniting the second industrial revolution in Germany. A typical US example is Henry Ford, who introduced the mass market automobiles. So until before Henry Ford, until the early 20th century, or even the first 10 or 20 years of the 20th century, the cars were very exclusive, very expensive products, only for a very, very small group of potential users, potential drivers. And they were hard to handle, they were hard to assemble, they were hard to construct. And that was something for the very high class people, adventurous people. They had a car and they were totally unique with that. And so it was not a mass market product. And Henry Ford introduced the assembly lines into the automotive production. He had the division of work, so there were people working on only very small slices of the production, and with other optimizations, let's put it that way, he reduced the price of the car. So one example is there were only black Ford Model Ts, which was the first car he put out. And he was saying you can have any color as long as it's black. Because then he did not need to handle various paints in the production lines. So he optimized the entire thing, and that was a typical event of the second industrial revolution. Another change that happened in that time was the introduction of the telephone. The, let's say, wired data transfer, like faxing, or that was had been introduced before, but the communication between different locations that may be far apart from each other by voice, that was new, and that was part of the second industrial revolution, because suddenly it was possible to talk to people far away and right away and fast and said, okay, I want to have this question answered. You ask the question, and then the person on the other side of the line was able to answer right away within a very, very short time frame, far faster than any letter or anything else at that time could have done it. Humans were still slaves of machines, and sometimes an even worse way than during the first industrial revolution. They had these super small segments of work, these slices of the process they were working on. They had very, very high repetition rates. So they made just one move with their hand hundreds of times per day and all days of the week and over months and years, and just doing this one thing. They had a super high monotony based on that. And Fritz Lang's movie Metropolis, and even more Charlie Chaplin's movie Modern Times, analyzed exactly that, talked exactly about that. This fact that people were totally destroyed by the monotony they had, the high repetition rates they had, by these super small work segments that they were working on. The concrete interaction between human and machine was still largely determined by the mechanical conditions, by the technology itself, and the limitation the technology experienced. Human characteristics like mental abilities played clearly a minor role. The analysis of work was very much focused on physical aspects. So, how much can he lift? How far can she reach? All the cognitive, the mental, the psychological properties of humans, the abilities we as humans have, were more or less completely disregarded. At least, little footnote again, the cognitive, mental, and psychological abilities came into focus in the Second World War, where scientists found out that a decline in vigilance, for example, among radar observers. So you have this radar signal and you're watching that, and only very small differences are between there is an maybe fatal object, there's an enemy somewhere, or there's everything is clear. So the difference between the signals of good and bad were very, very small. And this is something you can observe in any context. If you force people into watching something that is not changing too much, that is not adapting too much, that is very monotonous, they will lose the vigilance and they will not keep up their attention on the initial level. And this happens pretty quickly, like 15-20 minutes after the starts. And that was the first time when mental abilities, strengths, and weaknesses were analyzed in more detail and also were used to design machines. This is the end of the first episode on the four industrial revolutions we had. And next week, revolution number 3 and revolution number 4. Stay tuned. That's it for today. Thank you for spending time with me. I hope you were able to take something with you and do something for yourself that will be forever. For an ongoing exchange, you will find me on LinkedIn and on my websites, peter-rusker.com and beyond-hmi.de. Write me an email on the podcast at beyond-hmi.de. Tune in next time. Take care and stay healthy.